Evan Haas, our guest here on Calvus and Damien
in the house,
was the I.
E-I.
Spell that. Spell that.
The letter, capital letter E,
yes.
Dash, then the ocular. Spell your the I, E-Y-E.
I get it now.
And what were the instruments again?
Yes, and the performers?
Six players, harp, piano, two percussionists, electric guitar, and electric bass. The performers were students at Oberlin, and I believe that I played the guitar. The bassist was a guy named Anders Dahlberg, and the harpist was Trina Strubel, pianist Kelly Conley. Percussionists were Will Chase and Lauren Mock. Ah. Will Chase went on to a career in Broadway singing, a Broadway actor and frontman, interestingly enough.
That is a piece we don't normally hear on this program.
That's for sure.
I heard snippets of Harry Parch.
Harry Potter.
Potter, that's who. Lots of different wonderful, just memories, glimmers of people that I thought I'd heard sometime, but never in that context.
Certainly not. And we're still 20 years out.
Yeah.
From present time.
Mm-hmm.
Carry a little forward now. What was happening to you now? You got done with school, did you? And what happened? Where did you go?
When I finished at Michigan, a lot of music got written. And the summer after '96, I have to tell you this is that I always battled, and this is why I went to the Midwest rather than the New York. And when I left School of the Arts, as I did, there are a lot of complexes I had. And one was that I was always told when I was young, if you do go into music, you're going to be a teacher because you're not going to make any money doing anything else. So I always had this chip on my shoulder, can I be in music and not teach? Every time I finished one of my degrees, I was always thinking, well, if I don't really get any place, I'll be happy with that. I'm going to go somewhere and this will be the change in my life. And I was always welcomed into some new situation that was very good. And so I always went on. I didn't have the spine to turn my back on.
Did not have the spine.
And likewise with New York, I was always hearing it going up in North Carolina, if you're going to be in music, if you're going to do anything, you're going to go to New York. And so I had a chipmunk, no, I'm not going to go to New York. I'm going to go somewhere else. And so I sniffed around, heard of music schools that weren't New York, and that's how I ended up at Oberlin. I was actually headed for CIM. I didn't get in, so I ended up at Oberlin, which was great for me. It worked out well. I like that. Sure enough, finished my doctorate, didn't have a teaching job waiting. I had hoped to become a composer, and there was one job opening for composer in residence, which you don't see anymore, but I didn't, and I went at the interview, didn't get that. So I was really depressed. I was thinking, well, I didn't want to teach, but no one's offering me a teaching job. Now I'm really depressed.
You don't get either one.
Yeah.
Now you're back to...
I'm living at home with my parents for the summer of 96, and I'm going over to the local, to our music library.
Did you get a big I told you so out of it?
No. And no one knew what I was really feeling. I was actually just going out looking for money, trying to find friends. Can I go play bongos when you go play your guitar and make a little bit of money with you? On your gig, I believe I did some help some guy woodworker, strip stuff off of wood that summer.
Oh, we've all done that, Damien. What did you do? Didn't you work down at some woodworking place, and like Ethan Allen Furniture?
And got a lot of splinters.
A lot of splinters. Did you break things?
No, but it had the capacity to break me.
Yeah,
it's not a pleasant.
Yes, you were always such a good woodworker.
Later in that summer, I looked in the job book, and there was a job opening at a university in rural Kansas, Pittsburgh State in southeast Kansas. And I applied for that and got that job. And in late August of 96, I drove to Kansas and I taught at that school for 3 years. The irony of that is that literally less than a year earlier, when I'm hanging out with my friends in Michigan about to, go out of the nest, they'd say, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, I know what I don't want to do. I don't want to go to Kansas and teach your training at 8 a.m. in the morning 5 days a week.
No.
Guess what my assignment was? 8 a.m., 5 days a week, training.
Most hateful job in all of everybody hates the ear training instructors.
That's what I needed. I got what I deserved there. And anyway, so after 3 years, I literally made a move to conscious move. I did it with a safety net. I took a year of unpaid leave of absence, kept so I could come back to the job after a year. And I was going to choose one big city to move to and explore. I sampled some the summer of '99. And I chose New York because of a lot of experiences I had. I'd been fortunate enough to go to the McDowell Colony a few times, and so a lot of the artists I had met were all there. And so New York felt more.
Fall into things like the McDowell Colony? I mean,
I applied for it. I heard about it. I didn't hear about it. I didn't know it existed or know one was allowed to apply for a while. But I applied as a student and was lucky enough to get in. That was one of those things. I applied to things. I applied a lot of things I didn't get, and applied to a few things that I did get, and a lot of things I never applied for. You know, so it was just a mishmash. Whatever it was, really. I was never very organized about that stuff. I was in some cases very lucky, and in some cases I was always very felt like I'm not doing that. You know, no one wants me. You know, kind of a thing. But you know. But so anyway, moved to New York and been there ever since. Never went back. Resigned. It was a tenure track job, but I resigned and moved to New York and try to do it without teaching. Along the way, I actually did teach a couple of years at a college. It only lasted 2 years, so whatever. I don't dislike teaching. I'm here.
Teach in town or out of town?
No, it was at Concordia in Bronxville.
Okay.
2 years of ear training there, and that was fun. So I got by. When I first moved to New York, I got a lot of percussion gigs. It was really amazing. People just wanted to help. Always want to help the new person,
right?
And
sure.
Then kind of tapered off and. And I had eventually fell into a job that I have now, which is working in music publishing for E.B. Marx, and that's a very good job. I enjoy it. And so
what's your role at a publisher? Proofreader?
It's sort of everything classical and everything print related. And for E.B. Marx, I'm the only person, and it's everything to do with serious classical, whatever, and it's.
Well, when we first interviewed Darren Huggin, he was doing some work for one of the publishers.
Yeah.
That was one of his gigs before he got famous.
Do you have any music from the Kansas years? Did you write anything? Were there any influences?
Sure. My Kansas years were the kind of years where at the time, I felt like I wasn't doing anything, but when I look back and even play music for people, they say, well, it sounds like it's very lucrative. It sounds like it's very rich for you. You got all this stuff done. On the rock front, I fulfilled a dream of mine and did in a real studio, did a rock CD of 13 songs where I play all the instruments and did it right. Right, meaning that I, was critical of it. And I do have that. That's The Adventures of Freddy. And then I wrote my electric guitar concerto for band out there, concerto for electric guitar and symphony band, which I played at Michigan in 2000. And I wrote a choral piece. I wrote a few things.
Let's hear something from the windswept Kansas years.
Sure. How about something from the guitar concerto?
Oh, yeah.
Sure. All right.
I was going to relate this movement to that last thing we just heard. It's a very, very close relationship in a way, but we don't have to because I think it'll be heard anyway. So, if time is an issue, then let's play the third movement, which would be track three, which is so going to be extremely similar to the end of that last piece, which might be a nice segue or might make people think I only write that now. So.
And this is just called Guitar Concerto. Does it have any...
This is, interestingly enough, I've changed the title on this last one, but at the moment, this is third movement called Musica Celestis.
A.K.A. the Kansas.
A.K.A. the day God talked my ear off. Thank you.
Music by Evan Haas from his Guitar Concerto. That was which movement?
The last movement.
The last movement, and that third. And you're playing a University of Michigan concert band.
Right.
With the evocations of Copland-esque harmonies and sunflowers and saddle ladies.
And there's even some Chris Squire licks in there.
Definitely.
So you said off mic that this was not long before your meeting in New York that sort of closes the circle on our initial conversation.
Yes, it does. While it was mostly written in 98 and being touched up in 99 into 2000, that performance was October 6, 2000, literally a couple, 2 or 3 weeks before that party when I met my librettist, or talked to my librettist about setting his script. So
let us bring, let us have you bring you us forward through the opera period and what happened that caused this great, marvelous opera that is now available for complete listening on YouTube, of all places.
Right.
In sort of postcard-sized volumes.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's a 10-minute limit on every clip, if you wonder about that.
You have to get a director account, then it's 30 minutes.
Oh,
yes,
thanks.
It's free.
Oh, okay. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to recut everything now.
Everything.
That's the next 3 months.
Life is never simple.
After that first opera, he said he mentioned James Forrestal, who was the topic of the second opera, and that he went out a window and that he wanted to do that, and he gave me a script pretty soon after, and I said, great, and then that means that we'll have to do a third, too. Do you have any ideas for the third? And he actually did, so that was the fait accompli, I guess. But the second opera happened pretty quickly. The first one performed in March of 01. He delivered the script at the end of August of 01, which is, of course, we have to throw the 9/11 happens right in here.
Right
but
there,
right
yeah.
2 weeks before 9/11, I was actually down visiting, like, Gettysburg Battlefield and Antietam Battlefield and things like that. It was a very weird time, and I went to the hospital in Bethesda that Forrestal was thrown out or jumped out or whatever, and then I went
to... Yeah, we don't really know, do we?
We don't really know. But there was all the documents actually finally came out about 2 years ago or so, and I have to say that there was this person who this anonymous person wrote us who's like an underground DC sort of conspiracy theory guy who like wrote us and said was sort of like saying wow, is that right? Did that really happen? No, that didn't really happen. He said, well, I think this happened, and so it was very interesting. And then after a while, after those documents came out, he said, hadn't heard him for 3 years, and he says, well, I guess now you're probably going to want to rewrite your opera, because it didn't happen the way you said. You know, I think I was pretty clear that it happened this way, and I used a quote that a friend of mine gave me, which is that, well, you know, opera, art and the truth were never great bedfellows, so I don't think we're going to touch the opera. And he was just, I could tell he was completely miffed, but anyway, so there's 9/11, and then after all the weeks passed of that, then I think I started writing that in November, and then it was produced. I produced it myself again in May of 02, and then I was so enthusiastic during that process that I was like, I'm going to write an opera a year for the rest of my life. This is just great. Well, I started the third one. I got the libretto about a half year after that, and then started it in the spring of 03. And got to the point that I had written. I got 4 scenes done on a deadline for this little Brooklyn Arts Council grant. That gave me a few dollars to put something on, and so I put on 4 scenes of that third opera in the end of 03. And then a long time passed. I waited for opportunities I have to see where it's going to be done and all that before I actually finish writing it. And I thought I was going to actually write an orchestral score and everything and really do it upright. One thing led to another. It wasn't until 07 that I finally did it. Most of the writing, really, literally, the rest of the opera was written in like 19 days at the McDowell Colony over Christmas of 05, other than those 4 scenes. So, I mean, the short score, and then a lot of time orchestrating it in 07, early 07. After I knew I was going to do it, taking on all this great responsibility of fundraising, the budgets, where it went from the first opera was done on a budget of about $500, the second opera on a budget of about $8,000, and the third opera was like $45,000. So
For our listeners, take us through the process of producing an opera. How you find the people, how you find the space, how you find the money, how you find the audience, and how you enthuse all of those people, because it's not something you do overnight.
Well, working in reverse, the third opera, I'm afraid we didn't have much. The audience, we didn't find the audience, and I thought we would. The audience was the hardest part. We had an audience, certainly there. So we had some very devoted people who know about us and come see it. So I don't want to say that there's no interest, but I'd wished for more, you know. As far as producing it goes, I really began. It was one of those kinds of things, like if you've never lifted a hammer in your life and you decide to build your house because you're a big fan of Henry David Thoreau or something, and that was exactly how it began. I don't know how to produce an opera, but I do know that if I have a score, I need a place, I need people, and I need this. So I began. We put up posters for auditions, and people came, and I listened to people sing, and I said, "You'd be perfect for this."
It was. I don't have any money yet.
Right. I don't have any money yet. I knew that in the first opera, I think I took all the singers out for supper before the first performance, and the performers I gave, I think, everyone $100. The musicians were always more expensive than the singers, you know. And there was always, the sets were always.
And I'm sure singers love to be distinguished from musicians.
Of course.
I guess I should say the instrumentalists.
You're going to get more mail about your opera.
I know. And so it was always a question of how many rehearsals do I need, and then kind of figure out what I can pay the orchestra, the instrumentalists, and then find the singers on this kind of a budget who, you know, they have to be interested. And the space was usually coming through Gary in his theater contacts, although the third opera was really...
You could argue about Gary Hyde.
Yeah, Gary Hyde, the librettos. The third opera, I was sort of all mine. After the second opera, we had a disagreement on because I had brought in a director who had changed some things. He didn't like it. So we kind of agreed. We wrote the third opera together, but it really wasn't that I didn't... We didn't... I think... He was the caution. I think he said, "You do what you can do. Whatever you want. Here's the libretto. Do whatever you want." And he did. He did offer some help, but I sort of said it was kind of a mutual agreement. Okay, I'm going to shoulder this. I'm going to get it done. And so he offered some theaters actually throughout 06, 05, 06, 07, and they weren't quite what I wanted. I didn't get some of the. It was a little bit too of not terra firma for me for the amount of work I wanted to put into it. So I got this wonderful, through the Brooklyn Arts Council, they directed me to this man, Rodney Hurley, who runs Cumble Theater. And I remember going out and talking to him and just thinking, looking at the theater, how wonderful it was, and looking at the kinds of things they did, and just as I was telling him the story of the opera, thinking he just must think I'm absolutely crazy. And he said, "Okay, then when you want to do it?" And I was just like, amazing. And then when it was all done, I cornered him and I said, "You know, I can't believe you let me do it." He said, "You had a look in your eye."
Yep.
That was beautiful. So it was a wonderful theater, and then the quality of the theater spurred me on to really do fundraising and really write letters and raise money. I actually raised about half the money and spent the rest myself.
I think it's time to maybe hear a little bit of it, and also, why don't you tell the story of it?
Okay, the third one?
Yeah, the third opera. Yeah.
Okay.
This is the one we want everybody to pay attention to right now. So.
Okay. Yeah. Man, Biology of a Fall. The last days of Frank Olson, a biochemist who was working for the government to work on chemical warfare, biological weapons in the around 1950, and... Who worked on developing anthrax weapons and things like that at Fort Detrick. Now it's called Camp Detrick. It's still around in Frederick, Maryland. And the same division that was making his weapons were sort of put under the guidance also of an arm of the CIA, MK Ultra. That their paths crossed. MK Ultra was working on things like LSD and as using as a truth serum and mind control and that whole thing. And so. There was such things as Frank Olson had a lot of secret trips to Europe to witness things like interrogations using drugs and abusive techniques and basically on like World War II old Nazi POWs and things like that, and Nazi prisoners or ex-Nazis that were and incarcerated, and like in Sweden and Germany. So he there are a lot of things he saw that we don't know what he saw, but we knew, you know. And then so anyway, so that was sort of that's the reason most people think, like such as his son, that he maybe they wanted him out of the picture because he began to get a conscience. And so in a particular scene in the opera, and in a particular the seminal moment is that there is that at a lodge meeting in Western Maryland, six members of the CIA group MK Ultra and six members of Dietrich came together for a meeting, and in that meeting, a few of the people were dosed with LSD without against their knowledge, which I came to understand actually was not so unusual because they thought that it was an initiation rite. Let's see before you can go around and know what happened. You have to know what hit you without knowing it hit you before you can really comment on it. And so, but anyway, he didn't like that and he freaked out and over they quit the meeting early. He went home kind of over the weekend, began soul searching for the whole weekend and checked into the office on Monday morning, and anyway, he just finally said, "I want to quit." And I said, "Don't quit. Why don't we send you for some psychiatric treatment?" By the end of that week, he had gone out a window in Manhattan, and the opera is all that those events leading up to it. There's a begins with a scene setting up from earlier in 1953. That's Thanksgiving week, 1953, by the way. A setup scene, a little scene of him in the lab on a normal day of work. And then the lodge, the Almighty Lodge scene, which is a big 30-minute Paul Purges knocked, I like to call it. And
uh-huh. Yes, good description.
and then the second act is a lot of vignettes of all his weird visits in New York City. We know where he went. We don't know what transpired. And then the third act is the murder. So,
how is an opera different from a play?
Oh, that's fairly easy. The amount of dialogue that can be spoken is much greater reduced. What would take 2 minutes is basically, I use a times four multiplier. What would take a minute in a piece of theater would take 4 minutes in a piece of music, which I came to learn in this process. The words, while these operas are actually very indicative of a musician's, of a composer setting words that were probably better suited to the theater in the sense that Gary wrote actually some wonderful rhyming plays here. I mean, all three of them, he thought poetically, and I think he thinks of them as verse plays, and they are. But there's a lot of jargon and technological jargon in it. You know, I think I'm the first composer to set words like super heterodyme and brucellosis and you know things. I think that through this process, I think that an opera will benefit from in more intensified language. Poetic language is great if you can get it, but you can't. But I think finding an incredible poet to write the great libretto is every composer's. Going all the way back to, I think Mendelssohn spent his life looking for librettists and never found one, and he would have done a good opera. And a lot of composers missed out because they never found that person. And a lot of composers now can, same thing, have a librettist, and then they lose that librettist, and then where do you find? You can't replace, they're irreplaceable, really. They're like a good conductor, in a way. They're fewer around there than you think. Anyway, so the words have to be, I'm looking for words. Words have to be slimmed down, and a lot of my process with these librettos were actually cutting. I did a lot of libretto that I don't credit myself with until now. I talk about it. But I made a lot of modifications of libretto based on the music where the musical flow was going.
Well, talk about that musical flow. I mean, how did you know a lot of sort of. Operas from the past and carrying right to the present have this sort of overlap of words, things that don't happen in the way we converse normally. I mean, certainly there are groups of people in a room and they're talking to each other and other people are talking at the same time. There's something very different about how that's handled in a musical context.
Right. Since I had a lot of theatrically conceived librettos, there weren't a lot of duets and arias and duets and trios built in. So in my case, I had to create them, there were usually two things about that, two reasons to do that. One was that I just simply had to give the audience a break from one person singing to one person singing back, And so I just had to make it out of the words. I would just either write new ones to go along with it, or I would say, okay, here's a moment where these two thoughts can sound together, but sometimes it's few and far between. Another reason to do it is time, because there are a lot of words to get through, and sometimes this may be a bad reason, but sometimes you just have to shorten the scene, and so you have to find a way for them to intertwine them together if you have to have those words. So it's all in the editing process. What I would do now, if I were working with a dream librettist now where I had some input, and I've had people ask me, writers ask me, what are some things that we do together? I would say, well, you know, think about, in some, for the contrast, you have to take those opportunities. Don't leave it to me. If you have an opportunity for two or three people in a room together, you have to think of something that they can say at the same time. It will really help matters, you know. So, you know, that's a question of contrast, really, to the ear. The ear will just get tired of, I push the limit, I think, in these defenestration operas of just one person sings back, because that's all I was really had to work with. That and a few song moments, which were nice, you know, almost Broadway-esque, you know, verse chorus, which I'm very used to. But another way they're similar, theater and opera, is that anything on the stage you have to think of, except now in the technological world, unless you have video and some of the great bells and whistles we have now. But in the old-fashioned sense, and Gary was always great about this, is that these operas have to take place in a very simple setting, mm-hmm. and for a long period of time. And that's interesting. In theater, you can have My Dinner with Andre, and two people sitting at a table, and it just like blows your mind because the things that what they're thinking. But in music, because there's music, you have to have a reason to have the music go up in intensity. Mm-hmm. Really maybe only once in a scene, for instance, instead of like eight times in a conversation, we can get up and down really fast. But it has to be a little bit more controlled in an opera.
Did you discover that yourself, or did someone say you have too many ups and downs in a particular?
I think I discovered everything on my own. I discovered it in reverse. I discovered it by looking for ups and downs in a libretto, in a text that might be more dry. You know, it might be like in the beginning of the lodge scene of this opera, it begins with one man singing a report on the findings of our experiments. So where does that, I had to create something musical arch out of that. So I had to choose, right here is, even though it in some cases it turns out, it turns out goofy, because it's sort of like just saying that it's sort of the last thing he says. Musically, I make it stick out like a sore thumb. Like, this cloud of anthrax being blown over San Francisco, that's going to be the climax. Well, the thing just before is actually kind of just as bad too, but you know, it has to go somewhere. So if something might stick out. So I might change that. If something is really sticking out earlier in that line, I might just kind of eliminate it, or you know, you have to terrace it if that's the effect you want. So I discovered it by making arches out of the text that I just now I'm just thinking that, you know, there has to be some control, and preferably what you'd love to see is the librettist already have that in place for you. It's just one less thing for you to do. I was fortunate with Gary that he let me cut things. And at the end of our opera, I said, so did you notice all this play? Because he never wrote back to me when I said, you know, I started writing all my changes. I changed this, and just no response. I said, okay, so I just did it. And at the end, I said, did you hear that? And he said, I just call that good editing.
That's good.
All
right. I think we should hear some.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's settle in here and take a little break while we think, and then we'll be back. Our guest is Evan Haas here on Cavils and Damien
in the Haas.
And so, introduce this. We've just been off mic a little bit, deciding what to play, and we're about 15 minutes into what into where.
The seminal lodge scene, the Walpurgis Nacht, as aforementioned, we're almost halfway through it, and a lot is now going to happen. We are about I think, Frank, the dosing has already happened, and I think it's beginning to, just about a few seconds before this, one of Olsen's lines is, blue sparks a leap before my very eyes. So that obviously is, he's beginning to feel something. It's kicking in, and although the music begins with, in this particular case, he kind of, simultaneous with it kicking in, he's also becoming more defiant, and that's kind of he's kind of like tying his noose at this point with all these higher ups, and he says someone's been ranting about magic, and he says all this talk of magic falls fascist on my ears, and the ringleader Gottlieb, the guy in charge of the dosing, says I forgot we have a Christian here, seeing the thing about that, about being Christian, and then which is very Genesis-esque. Taken right out of Foxtrot or something like that. And then there a lot of things will happen. The most elaborate use of electronics in the opera here, there's a lot of mixing and rehashing of themes. A lot of it's too much to say, really, but I'll say that it finally ends with a choral setting of Edgar Allan Poe's The Conqueror Worm, which is apparently a favorite of Gary Hyde's. It's been in several things he's written, and it's also where we get the title Man, which I've had some criticism for, that people think it's just too man, you know, as a title, and people don't understand how it's really intertwined with the opera, and the main reason is that in that Edgar Allan Poe poem, he relates life as theater, and the person that wins is the conqueror worm, and is a theatrical, and what was supposed to happen in the script was a big worm supposed to come out and devour the whole party, and that was way over budget. So I set the poem musically like a worm. It's sort of this sort of like a Beethoven 6 slow movement, da 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 da, and it's like a worm crawling over the stage, devouring
and the Wagnerian leitmotif.
Yeah,
the one from the worm.
Okay. Worm.
Yeah, der Wurm.
Der Wurm. There was a play on the worm, actually. Later on, can I say this?
Oh, yeah.
I'll keep going. Earlier in the opera, the thing that Olsen went out to a movie with his family the Sunday night before the Monday, between the dosing and the Monday when he wanted to quit. They went to see a movie called Luther, 1953, and apparently very serious and dark movie. And apparently, like, not a movie he should have been seeing at that state of mind. So I was reading about Luther, and I tied in a couple more Luther references to make that thing fly. And, you know, there was the Diet of Worms, which is where all the
people
got together to condemn Luther.
Yeah.
Well, in the opening to the third act, when he's having Thanksgiving turkey with Lashbrook, he's drugged, and they're eating Thanksgiving dinner in an automat in Midtown Manhattan. And Lashbrook says, "How is it? How does it taste?" And he goes, "Like a diet of worms."
Oh,
which, lovely. Oh, yes, lovely, lovely.
Okay, so we hear this. This is going to be a 15-minute plus chunk of music that goes everywhere.
And turn it up. This is the kind of stuff you turn way up. Here it comes. Our guest is Evan Haas. This is from Man, Biology of a Fall.
All this talk of magic falls fascist on my ears.
I forgot. We have a Christian here.
Thank you.
But who is the deodorant for? Who are the diseased condoms for? And what about the swizzle sticks? What are the swizzle sticks for? That's a need to know. So ask swizzle sticks that release LSD. I assume you put them in drinks. You assume, do your job. Don't presume, pretend you're in the muff. Suck it up, zip your lip, be a pup. Just enjoy your trip. All players and their patience is at last. Sign your name, do your task, don't complain, and never, never ask what it means. In the end, forget the scene or you'll go round the bend. We'll tell you what you need to know.
Nothing less or nothing more, we'll experiment on who.
In fact, the very doors that the degenerates will pass through.
You mean servicemen?
That's a need to know.
A need to know.
Do I hear an echo?
Mind your head.
Watch your back.
Look straight ahead.
And don't hear from the track. Write a book.
Be my guest.
But look, we must avoid it in common.
There'll be no hanky-panky in Frankie.
Cause you're on a need to know.
Hello, nothing more or nothing less. There's no need for you to guess. The script is secret in this show. Everyone needs to know.
No.
What are you, an actor, or are you Sydney's lackey?
I'm a PhD like you.
And what do?
I find new ways to kill.
That's what I do. You bully scientists.
Go to hell.
Stop it. Incense on. That's
interesting.
What's interesting? Well, I don't think you've ever been that frank. Frank. That's interesting. What are you saying? Are you studying?
Yeah.
white swans and modern
Man.
And its hero, the
you have gone through the first death. And the second birth, I initiate you into the secret order of death. We are the sword of the left.
Now you know why we invited Evan Haas to the show.
But my question is, why didn't you have the audience that you anticipated? Who would not want to throw themselves at an opera like that?
I don't know. It was barely advertised at all. I sent press releases out, and no one really ran them. I think one New York magazine listed that the opera was being done. My local mailing list I put in the hands of another entity, and they told me they did it, but I know that they didn't. So no one got any postcards. But I told a lot of people that, you know, that a lot of people didn't know about it, didn't come, but, you know, whatever.
So this what's it like to be at the end of what is essentially a 10-year effort?
Oh, it's great. I wanted to doing this opera was definitely getting a monkey off my back, because it was going on and on longer. That it was not getting it done was weighing on me, and I knew that it had to get done. I would not do it, finish the trilogy, and so it felt great. I mean, it was completely the deflation after this was months long. You know, I just was recouping for a long time, and
walking
I'm over
in,
it now.
Sort of walking into walls, wondering what you were going to do with your life.
Yes, yes, definitely. I mean, the video project I was looking forward to, but I couldn't even really start it for a while. And cutting the video, and really, there's two whole other nights. I have four nights, so I only focused on the latter two, but the first two, I haven't even listened to the recordings yet. You know, but they weren't bad at all. But I'm not, you know, so it's fun. Now, the next thing is, now that I've cut a video between the last two nights, I have two things to do: choose scene by scene which of the two nights I would put on a DVD, and then subtitle it, which is always fun. Didn't take that long.
Right. And so that will be available on DVD at some point.
Yes.
Yeah, because right now we can see it on YouTube.
See that whole opera on YouTube. And yep. The second opera, I only have the first act, but there's nothing preventing me except procrastination of getting the rest of the second opera, so you can see both of them. Yep. The first opera I don't have video of.
And our guest is Evan Haas, H-A-U-S-E. Look up, also search on YouTube for Biology of a Fall, Man, Biology of a Fall. You can find it there. It comes right up. And it's actually nicely done in these little segments, so that you can kind of go and get something to eat.
Yeah,
you can create your own commercials in between.
I missed the smell-o-vision to be part of the video.
Once you're done with all the cutting and all the video, what are you doing next?
Good question. Last night I just had a premiere in Albany of an 8-minute piece, and that was a nice thing, and that was all I'd been thinking about. So I'm writing a duo for piano and tuned in marimba and with vibes, and then that's all I know right now. Big projects that I want to do. Nothing's. I want to finish we'll call it a collection of orchestral movements that, you know, I want to, I'm always on the search for a new librettist to work with, or a new topic to work with, or maybe write my own libretto. There's just, I want to one day write my own libretto for sure, because,
and find someone else to write the music?
Right. Would I tolerate that? I don't know. So no, I don't have a ready answer for that. I don't have any big projects. I just want to, whenever I read anything with literature, in terms of literature, I'm terrible. All I can do is look for ideas. And I don't do anything. Whenever I appreciate anyone else's art, in any medium, all I really do is think about how I can use it, and it's just I wish I could be an appreciator, just an appreciator sometimes, you know. But
I think To Serve Man has never been turned into an
maybe
opera.
It hasn't. That's true.
Did you guys
Serve Man?
The Twilight Zone episode?
No.
Oh, well, we'll tell you about that later.
Okay.
Well, thank you for joining us. This has been fantastic. Oh,
thank you. It was great to go through some very early stuff and really show some of the rock, where that gets in there. So
and we'll certainly make the announcement when you form your death metal band.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Evan Haas here on Calvus and Damien
in the house.